Hello, you're listening to the Brainy Speech Therapist podcast. We're your hosts, Helen McLean and Jan McIntosh Brown. Here, we aim to look at all aspects of brain injury, from the research to the rehabilitation, and always through the lens of speech and language therapy.
The opinions and views expressed in this podcast are of the individual and should not be considered professional advice. If you have a brain injury, suspect you have a brain injury, or think someone you know has a brain injury, please seek dedicated professional advice.
Hello all, welcome to this episode of the Brainy Speech Therapist podcast. I'm Helen McLean.
And I'm Jan McIntosh Brown.
We hope this episode finds you well. Today, we are joined by Dr. Nicholas Benn, a speech and language therapist, researcher and educator. Nick, thanks so much for joining us. Can I start off by asking you to just tell the listeners a bit about yourself?
So, yes, and thank you for inviting me to talk today. So I'm a speech and language therapist, originally from Australia, as you can probably tell or will tell as you listen to me more. And I trained as a speech and language therapist and have over the years become more interested in research and now a lecturer and a researcher at City University of London.
Great. And so how long did it take you to sort of make that move from clinician to researcher?
That was something that happened over many years. I kind of remember as a new grad having a bit of interest in research, but not really wanting to jump into research straight after graduation. I finished university at the age of 21, I think, and so many years ago. And I just wanted to get out into the field and experience the field and work out what areas I enjoyed most and what areas fascinated me the most. And that after several years of working in Australia, I then came over to the UK, and that's almost like something that a lot of Australians do. We kind of want to travel the world, and that was always the intention, to come over and travel. Before I'd come over here to the UK, I'd done a job for about a year and a half working in brain injury and working with people with traumatic brain injury. And I found that area really fascinating. And so when I first came over to the UK, I was just looking for clinical jobs in rehab settings, working with people with brain injury. And I think as time evolved, I started realizing that sometimes I just didn't know what I was doing. I didn't know where to look in terms of the evidence. I didn't know whether what I was doing was effective or was having an impact. And it got me reading a lot more about brain injury. And the more I read, I started realizing that there's a lot of gaps in our knowledge as speech and language therapists, and there's not a lot of research out there. And that got me having some discussions with some people back in Australia, and I then did my master's degree in research, and then it kind of opened my eyes up to a completely different world. And then I ended up going down into the research route and doing my PhD. And I found it just a really fascinating journey. And I found it really interesting to explore kind of how research is created and how we develop the evidence for the profession, if that makes sense.
And I think, you know, something that you said twigged for me, Nick, that as clinicians, we hear a lot about, you know, doing research within our clinical practice. But as a clinician, that can often seem like, what does that mean? How do I do that? You know, and I mean, I'm still asking myself that question after 23 years of practice. So, do you have, I've heard you speak about it. Do you think you might share some thoughts with us on that?
When I was a clinician and was reading up about brain injury, I was reading about lots of really good ideas or research ideas. You read research papers I may have gotten off the internet. And I started thinking to myself, well, how do I do this? How do I do this in a research way? Or how do I start to implement research into my clinical practice? And it always started with a single patient. It always started with a case that had walked through the door where I just didn't know what I was doing. And I basically would, almost a bit like a service evaluation, I got myself thinking, okay, I need to take outcomes. You know, those first few sessions, I need to kind of take some measure of an outcome that I can use to measure progress. And then I'd, you know, document what I was kind of doing session after session. And then I'd do those outcomes again after I'd implemented an intervention. And I would do that on a number of different participants, or I say participants now as a researcher, but I'd do it on a number of my patients. And then I would sit back and just go, okay, well, I've now done it on a couple of patients. Do I think it worked? You know, or what worked well? What didn't work? Why didn't it work? And sometimes the difficulties that we have in working with such a heterogeneous group of patients becomes more obvious when we're doing it, those single case studies. And you realize that sometimes research is in very clinical settings that are not always representative of clinical practice.
You've kind of touched on something that Jan and I were speaking about before we started recording, actually, which is around outcome measures. It would be interesting to hear your thoughts on kind of speech and language therapy outcome measures, but kind of what you're saying there is pretty much what we were saying. That difficulty with having something that you could apply to all of your patients when it comes to the brain injury caseloads, because everyone is so individual, and I think we're both kind of struggling a bit to kind of go, what could we use, you know, regularly? And we were a little bit envious of, for example, our physiotherapy colleagues who've maybe got lovely erg balance scales and things like that to, you know, get they can get a figure and they can then evidence, you know, this is where this person started and here's where they are now. And we were saying, you know, it's about has that person achieved what they want to achieve, but maybe that's, you know, that's important to the person and it's good for us as clinicians, but maybe in terms of evidencing that what we're doing is working, it's harder to show that, isn't it? I mean, I don't know if you've had other thoughts around kind of us demonstrating that we're doing what we say we do.
It's really interesting what you say, because I remember kind of the early noughties when I was doing treatment with people with brain injury, and I was kind of taught or told that, you know, with what you need to do is social skills training. That's what speech therapists do. They do social skills training. And so I was doing, you know, I was teaching people how to take turns, how to start the conversation, how to maintain the conversation, how to end it, and so forth. And it was when I started reading the literature, I realized that there's actually very little out there that about social skills training at that time in the early noughties. And so I was just like, well, and I remember seeing some patients like probably 6 months after I finished therapy, I just happened to see them down the local street. And I realized that all those skills that we were practicing and training for months, they were still having those difficulties. And it made me go, well, what was I doing? How did I ever? So it made me start thinking about the evidence and what it is that we do, but actually also look at the outcomes. And so what I did with outcomes is I just looked at, well, what outcomes are out there? And this was kind of 2005, 2006. There's very little out there, to be honest. I was pulling textbooks and articles just to look for outcomes. And then I just tried different outcomes with patients and to get a feel for what gave me the most meaningful information about what that patient was doing in sessions, but also to identify what outcomes could show change. Because sometimes the questionnaires and scales, they're good for assessing whether someone's got a difficulty or not, but they're not necessarily able to be what we say sensitive to change. They're not going to show change from rehabilitation. So I started going down that kind of looking at that. And around about that time, 2006, 2007, there were some really good papers published by Cynthia Dorberg's group in the USA and Skye McDonald's group in Australia, specifically on social skills training and whether it was effective or not. And a lot of these studies found that you can make changes to people's social skills, you know, from doing this training. So there's no, it's not to say you won't make improvements, but actually those improvements don't always extend to improving a person's social or community integration or satisfaction with life, for example. And I thought to myself, that's exactly why I do social skills training, to have an impact on those bigger outcomes. And if it's not having those improvements, what's going wrong here? And that's what made me really interested in research and understanding, you know, other ways of delivering intervention, or understanding what I now call, what are the active ingredients of an intervention? What makes an intervention work? So it's not simply saying, oh, do social skills training, because we know in clinical practice, the way I might do social skills training may be different to the way another therapist does social skills training. So what are those components that you need for it to work? If that makes sense.
Yeah, no, completely. And it is that thing, I think, where everyone might approach a task or an intervention in a slightly different way. And I think that can apply to lots of aspects of brain injury rehabilitation within speech and language therapy. But I think that's because we've got to tailor our interventions to match the individual and to what they're like pre-injury and to the type of injury they've had and what their goals are. I think it's a tough one to crack, I think. I don't know about you in terms of kind of coming down to, okay, here's a good way for us to measure consistently, is this working? I mean, have you found something that you would say, okay, this is something we could kind of rely on? Is there something you could put out there to our listeners and to me personally?
It's a hard one, because I think you're absolutely right, because as clinicians, we need to modify, adapt, tailor the intervention to the person that we're working with, you know, make it individualized, make it patient-centered. And so a lot of the literature you start reading now, they talk about approaches to intervention. But in talking about approaches, they're also talking about, some of them are talking about guiding principles or things you need to consider. So for example, you know, interventions need to be individualized. So this is about setting goals that are individualized, patient-centered, set collaboratively, specifically addressing the concerns of the client or patient. You know, another one may be, you know, doing treatment in real life contexts. This is one that I find, you know, I'm proved time and time again how important this actually is. So, you know, I remember someone saying to me that, you know, if you wanted to help someone independently, you know, order a cup of coffee at the local Starbucks or Costa or, you know, wherever, do you do this in a clinical setting with a table and two chairs, or do you simply just skip that and go, well, if the coffee shop's literally down the road, why don't we just take the patient to the actual coffee shop that they're going to be ordering the coffee in, and let's practice it in the real life context? And, you know, when you treat people in those real life contexts, you're more likely to get kind of that maintenance and generalization of skills outside of the clinic-based environments. So I think real life context is important. The more I see in the literature, there's more leaning to more group-based interventions. You know, I remember back in the late 90s, early noughties, we did groups simply to kind of get people off our caseload, to kind of manage our, you know, our lengthy waiting lists. But now I'm starting to see groups are therapeutic in of themselves. You know, the interaction, the feedback they give, patients give to one another and each other, is really valuable for making change. So I guess the other thing is thinking about working with communication partners. So working with families, working with friends, working with significant others, and helping them develop the skills that they need to communicate better. So I kind of, the way I see interventions working for people with brain injury these days is by taking these guiding principles and implementing those into our kind of into our interventions in practice.
A couple of things that you were that raised some thoughts with me, Nick, from the CCD second symposium last year. That I think what Lynn Turkstra said about first impressions. I'm like, yeah, let's not worry about the whole interaction if we can just focus on the first impression. So, you walk in, the person's at the counter, just get articulating clearly, getting all your words out, and looking confident, feeling confident, and so that's a big focus for me now, is just that first impression. And then the other thing that twigged in my brain as you were talking was when you were talking about the benefits of working within groups. Forgive me if I say his name wrong, but is it Jerry Huebner?
Yeah, Hepner.
And peer mentoring, so supporting our people support each other, So those are some things that that really impacted on me from that symposium, and I'm trying to embed into my practice,
And I think that's a real, that's an indication of what's happening for our profession at the moment, which is more of this research is coming out, and you are seeing research around, peer mentoring, or Susan Howes done some work around peer-led interventions. So there's some really nice stuff there. And what you say about the first impressions, I remember as a new grad being taught, when you watch that person with brain injury, what is it? What's the one thing that strikes you most? What's the one thing that you think, if you've only got a short period of time to have an impact, what is the one thing you could change in that person that would have the most positive impact on their interactions with others? And that stuck with me for a very long time, because if we say that there's all these skills we need to change, and we've got a time limited period of time to do that, then we're inevitably going to fail at some point. Retaining, recalling, remembering all that, like remembering all those skills in every interaction, in every context, is actually quite a difficult, high level cognitive task to do. So by simplifying the task, by simplifying what it is they need to work on, we stand a better chance of them making improvement.
And again, sorry, Helen, you've
No.
twigged another thought, another memory from back in the abyss of my mind, from my early days of coming to work with people with brain injuries. When I first started, we would, as a multidisciplinary team, be setting like impossible numbers of goals. I couldn't even remember the goals. And then I went to do a course with Sheila McDonald. And she talked about the kingpin. What's the kingpin goal? And I thought, that, like what you're saying, Nick, that's really good, isn't it? Let's go into appointments with people and go, what is it? Like, what's the most predominant thing, or what does that person really want to work on, rather than making a list of all the possible things we could work on?
And the nice thing is if you've got that kind of main goal, I mean, I'm the same as you. I remember you'd have your MDTs, your OT would have several goals, your psychologist has several goals, your physio, your speech therapist, and you kind of, and like you, I could never remember all the goals from all the different professions. And if I couldn't, how could my patient? And so the way I like to think about goals is you say, what task, what is it you want to do? So if the patient, say, for example, wants to go and buy KFC independently from the local takeout shop, well, that requires all the MDT to be involved in that task, because you've got to think about money management and physical mobility and getting your message across clearly and, you know, negotiating, you know, if they haven't got something, you know, that the patient wants. Like, all our goals can sit beautifully under this main goal of getting KFC independently. And I think having a couple of those big goals is what we should be communicating with our clients. And then behind the scenes, we as clinicians are thinking, yes, we've got our two or three goals that we're working on to achieve that task, if that makes sense.
I think it makes total sense. And I'm thinking within our, the team I'm a part of, exactly as you say, Nick, we've got speech therapists, psychologists, occupational therapists, physiotherapists, and we've all got our own goals, and we are maybe thinking of the larger, longer term goals of a return to work, or being able to, you know, go to a family wedding that the person's really keen to be able to walk at and dance at. And and then from a speech therapy point of view, I've got patients saying to me, yes, but there's going to be people there that I've not seen since my injury, and I'm worried about coping with the noise of this party and not be able to keep on track, and the nerves of it all, and the fatigue element, and just that kind of complete interaction of all these cognitive skills and physical skills that we of course have to look at it as an MDT, but we've all got our little bit to work on, haven't we? And I think patients really appreciate it when we can kind of look at it in that way, that we see that we don't just sit as the just the speech therapist, that actually maybe what I'm doing in terms of potentially working on your social skills and your confidence in that actually means that maybe you're implementing a little bit more fatigue management, and you're reducing your anxiety about being in these situations that potentially occupational therapy and psychology are also working on. And I know that that's slightly leading me into another area that I thought would be interesting for you to speak about, and if you have opinions on it, that there's maybe a little bit of blurring of lines sometimes between our profession and, say, psychology or OT. I don't know if you have thoughts on that.
That's a really interesting one, because I realise that we're both using the words multidisciplinary team. And I don't know if in brain injury rehab, that's the term we should be using. I feel we should be using either inter or transdisciplinary team, because that's where rehab works at its best, is when we work as such a blended team that we, you know, we recognize that each profession has their level of expertise, but we do tasks, we do activities that involve the skills of all the other professionals. So take, for example, I take my patient down to the coffee shop. I'm going to need to know a little bit about physical mobility. I might need to know a little bit about incontinence or toilet management if they need to go to the toilet. I need to know a bit about money management, how they manage the money when they actually hand things over. I think one of the best teams that works for someone with brain injury is where there is trust and acceptance between all members, and there is that kind of blurring of boundaries, because I think sometimes the roles can almost be indistinguishable from each other in some respects. But that can be a hard and challenging thing for some people to accept. It requires a lot of trust within the team. It requires a lot of communication and talking. One of the things I used to do clinically is myself and the occupational therapist, we used to always, the very first session with our patient, we used to take them out for coffee so that they could do their kind of transfer assessment, look a bit about money management, look at toilet management, for example, and then I could look at their communication within a real life context. And we learned so much from each other from doing that as one of our first initial assessments, she trusted me to do a lot of the OT stuff, and I trusted her to do a lot of the communication stuff. And Yeah, I just think it's a different way of thinking about team working, but I think it's where teams work most effectively for people with brain injury.
I really like that, Nick. I think I might apply that. Mm-hmm. I think we've got, I work with really great OTs, I'm so glad to say, and I think they would be really open to that. I think of, like you, where it's worked best, it's where we've done that. And I'm really pleased to say that the OTs will come and say to me, oh, I was out in the community and, you know, the person didn't know how to stand in the queue and got really irritable with the, you know, so could you come with me next time? And I'm like, oh, love it. Thank you for asking me. Because I think sometimes you can get bogged down in the old, you know, doing assessments, doing motor speech, you know, and you're like, oh, where is the world outside, you know? So
I think it's that interesting thing of taking speech therapy out of the clinic room, which I think there's still a bit of that kind of traditional model of thinking. And
rehab,
I think,
happens in the, yeah, in the therapy room.
And I think it, for some people, it feels a little bit like we're maybe pushing it too far, or are we heading into kind of occupational therapy territory by wanting to go out for a coffee? And sometimes people can feel that they really need to kind of justify that. And I think not every team's there yet, are they? and being open to doing those things.
I think it's about just us as professions not feeling protective, like not feeling, okay, you know, every time a professional talks to a patient, they're communicating, and we can help guide them and help them with the most effective way to do that. But I feel 100% comfortable if they want to do a little work on communication, and I can direct them to work on that, if you know, and give them advice and suggestions. And I think it's about us all feeling comfortable and not feeling so, I don't know, so I guess you don't want to be so protective of your field that you're kind of in a position where you're saying, look, that's only for me to do, please don't work on those things, because that's what I'm working on in therapy. Because actually, if we're all working on each other's skills in every single therapy session, then aren't we going to make progress faster? So, and actually, you know, in speech therapy, we think of comprehension, expression, social communication, reading, writing. You know, I can't work on all of those areas in the small amount of time I have to do therapy with a patient. So if someone else is able, with my guidance, to do a couple of those tasks and practice some of those skills, then, you know, I'm all up for it. Because it means the patient will benefit most from all this kind of input.
That is the thing, isn't it? It's about what works best for the patient. And yeah, completely agree. It's about communication, and it's about trust. Definitely, definitely. I'm realising that we've done lots of discussion and we've not even touched on your areas of research and on your area for your PhD. So, tell us, what was the topic of your PhD? Is that maybe a good place to start in terms of topic?
So my PhD was all on what we call project-based intervention. So this is an intervention that was kind of proposed by Mark Ilvesaka kind of in the early noughties. And it's a way of working with patients in a group setting where they have a specific, concrete, tangible end product that they need to develop. And the group work together to develop that product. So by product, what I mean is they could be creating a video, an educational video or a pamphlet, or indeed a podcast, as I had some of my patients do. And through the course of the group, you're working on their communication skills, you're working on their problem solving, their reasoning skills. So it provides this kind of therapeutic real life environment where they're working towards their own individual goals, but at the same time working on this bigger, broader goal that is the project. And so my kind of PhD was also all about testing that idea out and seeing whether it works. And I think just seeing whether it's acceptable to people that receive that kind of therapy, and whether it's feasible, whether it can actually be done. So I worked with 21 patients across the UK over about 1.5 year period to kind of look at this in a bit more detail.
And we recently reviewed an article, your 2019 article, Nick, is that correct?
Yeah,
at our Brainy Speech Therapist Journal Club. And yeah, and what I really liked about it, and I think you mentioned it earlier, was the ingredients. So you had this really nice list of, you know, the ingredients of the group-based intervention. So I thought, right, that synthesizes it a little bit for me and helps guide what I'm thinking about for myself and for the people who might participate in the group. So yeah, what did you get from the article?
Yeah, I mean, I know that you've done kind of face-to-face training about the project-based groups pre-COVID, obviously. Yes. That I was able to attend down at the university, and along with previous podcast guest Vicky Mayer through in Lothian, and I completely see where you're coming from in terms of the benefits of group, and I'm a huge fan of peer support. You know, we in our service we call them just peer support groups. You know, they're not necessarily for communication, although I think there's definitely benefits there. But yeah, I think having something like that, and as Jan was saying within that article, kind of laying out, right, how can a group intervention actually work and what would you do week on week, and having run a project-based group just on one occasion since the training with yourself, the people that we had who came to that really enjoyed it, were so motivated to come every week. They would be happy to negotiate tasks between themselves. We had one person who went above and beyond every week, you know, because this really gave him some structure to his day in between the kind of group sessions, because he was really struggling with a lack of structure, and this was something he could get his teeth into. And they produced a leaflet about brain injury that they then presented to their family members at the end, that they wanted to say, this is what I want you to understand about what's happened to me and about where I'm at now. And it was so nice to see them working together towards a common goal. And I think we wouldn't get that from just working with a speech therapist. You know, it could only happen because they were there together, working on that as a unit, as a team themselves. So it's certainly, I think, something that would be great to see happening more and more.
It's so lovely to hear you describe all of that, because I was just like, that's exactly what projects are about. And I remember when I did the study, and I did the study saying that the treatment needs, well, not needs to, but I delivered it in a 6-week period. And, you know, I kind of did that because I think a lot of NHS clinicians talk about 6-week blocks of therapy. And, you know, I'm not tied to the 6 weeks. I think in some places projects will take longer. Sometimes projects may take a shorter period of time. And I think that's why it was important to define what the active ingredients were of that project. And one of the things I was really amazed by when it came to recruiting participants and getting them involved, because one of the really big things of this study was we had 90% attendance throughout all the groups, which is pretty impressive for a chronic long-term post-injury group. And actually it was this kind of concept of, do you want to be involved in a project that can help others? And I'd never really explored or acknowledged that this kind of concept of them being the experts of having had an injury, and we want to use your expertise to help other people, is so powerful, so meaningful to these guys, that it really has an impact on how motivated they are, how engaging they are within sessions. And it's something I kind of, since doing that project, is it's something I keep talking about with my existing patients now, because helping others is just so powerful, so meaningful to these guys.
I think there's a real there's another really important point you made there, Nick, that I get this drive to think of ways to help our people contribute again, because I think, you know, you have an injury or you have an illness and all of a sudden you're a receiver, you know, you're receiving this care and this nursing and this rehab, and it's all about people doing things to you.
Yeah.
But, you know, the doing a project based to help others, it's a way that actually you can now become a contributor to the community. You know, I've always wanted, I've tried many times to do, like, having people contribute to food banks, and I'd love to have, like, make blankets for the homeless and things, but not many guys want to knit or crochet. So, you know. So the food bank seems to work quite well, but then we find people will take all the food. So, But you mentioned in the article about a manual.
Yes. Yeah. So basically the manual is kind of tied to the course at the moment. It's not out there in the public domain. But so what I've kind of been doing is running a course, and I'll be running a course online actually come June this year, actually. So it's the course, Helen, that you've attended before, because I got a lot of interest from other people around the world who were just interested in this. So basically, as part of the course, you know, the manual is something that will be provided. The manual is very much a lot of the PowerPoint slides, the pro formas, the scaffolds, the things that I use during that trial. And I'm more than happy to share that as part of the course. I think for me, it's, you know, you can have a manual, but that doesn't necessarily mean that you know exactly how to implement it. And I think the story behind how you use these scaffolds and sheets and materials is just as important. And watching videos of patients using this stuff helps you as a clinician bring that therapy alive in your own head and start to think of your existing clients and think, oh, this could actually work for whatever reasons. So yeah.
And I'm definitely on the list for that group, Nick, so we just need some more people to register, don't we?
I think it will go ahead no matter what.
Oh, great, Nick. Now you really encouraged me. That's fantastic.
Well, I think if you're saying the course will run in June, and we'll have this episode out before that, and so yeah. We'll certainly include a link to signing up for the course within the show notes if you're happy enough for us to do that, Nick. And I, Nick's not paying me anything to say this. I definitely recommend attending the course, and it's such a good therapy tool, such a good way to see people that you think are, you know, maybe having difficulties in some context, but actually when you see them working alongside their peers, maybe there's elements of their communication, there's strengths that come out that you're maybe not seeing in one-to-one sessions. I remember seeing that for one or two of my people, and thinking, actually, you know, you've got a lot more going on that's strengths than I think we've all realised, you know, and they really benefited from it. And I think just the course certainly gave me the confidence, and my colleague and I the confidence to give it a go, you know. And like you're saying, you know, it gives you a template, and we're not reinventing the wheel when we've got that template that you've worked so hard to put together. So
no, that's absolutely. I think with projects, one of the hardest thing with a project is what is the project that you're going to work towards? And this, I think, is incredibly threatening for a therapist, because for the project to be most meaningful, it has to be driven by the patients themselves. So it's no use me going into a therapy session, say, this is the project, this is what we're going to work on, let's all work on it. Actually, it's got to come from the patients. If it comes from the patients, it's going to be more motivating and meaningful to them. And that's threatening to a therapist, because essentially you go into the first one or two sessions having no idea what the project is going to be. And, you know, but actually it evolves over time. And when I did the study, some projects, the participants got the project idea within the first session. So if you look, if you go onto YouTube and type in brain injury projects, you can see a lot of these projects online. They're publicly accessible. And there's one project called Wear No Different. And it's a video that is highly complex. They came up with the idea in the very first session. They started planning, prepping. They did loads of videotaping and editing behind the scenes. They did it themselves. And so we end up with a really complex project. But I had other groups where it took them 5-6 sessions to agree on what the project was going to be. So yes, the project end product was rather more simple, but it was their project that they had come up with and they had developed. So it was just as meaningful to them. And you'll see when you look at the pamphlets, they're, you know, if they have spelling mistakes, grammatical errors, punctuation errors, you know, it's their decisions. Everything that's in those sheets or in those videos are decisions that were made by the patients themselves. So they're not always perfect pieces of work, nor are they intended to be. They're supposed to be pieces of work or projects that the patients with brain injury, they take complete ownership of. I think that's really important because I think it is hard because as therapists, we want everything to be perfect and, you know, well-polished. And actually that's where project-based therapy, it's not necessarily about that, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, absolutely. I think, like you say, it's the ownership and that's so intrinsic to the kind of the motivation that I think we're touching on for sure. I'm aware, Nick, that we are maybe starting to come towards the end of the time that we've got together. So yeah, we always ask our guest for one key idea that listeners should take away from the discussion that we've had or the topics we've covered in our conversation. What would be that one key idea for you?
Do you know, it was interesting because I was reflecting on this, like what would be the key information I'd give across. And I think it, just as we've been talking, I think it's kind of changed in my mind a little bit. And I think one of the things that I think is most important, and so one thing that I think we as therapists need to do as often and as frequently as possible, is simply just to listen to our clients, you know, put them front and center. And allow, you know, and just find what's most meaningful for them. Because if we can actually deliver interventions that they find meaningful, that they've been directing or they've been involved in planning, then it's likely that those therapies are going to be, the skills that they learn through those therapies is going to be most effective in the long term. I think that's the learning point I'd say with respect to kind of working with people with brain injury. And I think in terms of my own journey is I never expected to be in this place 20 years after graduating. I never thought this would be where I'd be. But one of the things I constantly say to people is, you know, just be open to the opportunities that present to yourself throughout the years of your career. And speech and language therapy is such an amazing career. And I suspect, you know, OTs and physios could say the same of their own careers. You know, something that you do today doesn't necessarily need to be what you're doing tomorrow. And be open to the opportunities and kind of be brave and be open to those, because I think there's so much that we can all do within our own jobs and within our own professions. So I don't know if I've said that in the right way, but hopefully you get my idea.
I think what you said is very inspiring, Nick. Mm-hmm. You know, I absolutely love the advice to listen to the person and then also to be open. What more could we want?
And yeah, I would agree, Jan. You know, I think we're, you know, recording this. I think probably if people are playing podcast bingo, they could probably tick off, yep, Helen's about to mention COVID. but just like, you know, all of us have been under a lot of pressure, but I know from speaking to speech therapy colleagues that they have experienced a lot of stress over the last couple of years. And so I just think it's nice to have someone just kind of acknowledge, you know, we do a great job and we are good listeners, and that exactly what you said, what we do today doesn't need to be what we do tomorrow. But I think, I don't know, it's maybe the speech and language therapy personality. We do put a lot of pressure on ourselves to do the absolute best that we can, and what we worked one time maybe needs to work every time. And just to reflect that actually we can give ourselves a little bit of breathing space and just to approach things in a different way. So just, yeah, kind of taking what you were saying there and running with it a bit. But yeah, I really like that.
If I just add in my own reflection on COVID, because I think, you know, it is something that we've all experienced over the last few years. And I think everyone in whatever position they're in have had a stressful few years. But actually, one of the things I've seen through COVID is opportunities arise, opportunities I never thought were possible. You know, over the last few years, we've been doing telehealth groups for people with brain injury and seeing some lovely results. So I just think where there is stress and where there's a difficult circumstance, if we can come through it, but also look for the opportunities within that, because I don't know about you, but my understanding, my knowledge, my experience of technology is far beyond where I would have thought it could have been or would have been 2 years ago. So I sometimes try and think as positively and reflect positively on kind of these kind of situations where possible.
Totally agree, Nick. So we are drawing to a close. Our time is up. It's been... like I should sing.
Well, don't let me stop you.
Yeah, the time is near.
I'll not join in. I'll not put you through that. But no, it's been lovely to speak to you, Nick. I think there's so many topics that we've not had a chance to cover. And so hopefully if you're able and willing to come back and join us on another occasion, because I think there's lots of other areas of research that you've covered. We've not even touched on being a lecturer and all that involves. So there's lots of areas still to discuss, isn't there? And we'd love to have you back if that would be something you'd be open to.
No worries, more than welcome to.
And yeah, we'll give you we'll put together a little kind of list of things that you've maybe referenced around the course, and maybe a couple of other papers that you've mentioned. And yeah, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Nick.
We'll be in touch, no doubt. Okay.
Thank you.
All right.
See you later. See you virtually in June.
There you go. Yes.
Okay. All right.
Bye.
Thank you, guys. See you later. Bye.